Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am really excited to have with me Andrew J. Scott. Andrew is founding partner at 7% Ventures, an early stage VC fund investing in technically challenging deep tech and transformative ventures across the UK, Europe, and the US. Prior to founding 7%, Andrew had spent over a decade as an entrepreneur and founder of multiple software ventures, including exiting WorldwideCity.com, the world's first online digital news archive, to CMG PLC, before moving into investing and advisory. In 2019, Andrew co-founded Allocate, a European event helping limited partners find suitable general partners and funds with a mission to accelerate the European tech and venture ecosystem. Andrew, welcome to the podcast. It's absolutely wonderful to have you here with me.
Great to be here.
Excellent. Let's dive straight in. You'd spent well over a decade from back in the earliest days of the internet building companies and then sort of jumped the fence, first consulting as an entrepreneur in residence or an EIR at Chalmers Ventures and then Digitas LBI before launching 7%. We've had a few operator turned investors on the pod in the past, and I'm always interested in what drove that change to move from building to investing. What do you think of the claim that operators don't make great investors, but that investors can often make great operators?
Great question. Well, I changed because I'd done 6 startups over the years, got kicked out of college, had some success, had quite a bit of failure as well. And when I came back from the US, because I lived there for a couple of years on the West Coast and spent a lot of time there, I had to decide, you know, do I do another company or do I flip onto the investment side and solve some of the challenges and frustrations I had had as a founder in Europe? And ultimately, I decided my skills and enthusiasm was leaning that way. You know, I hadn't had a 100 million or $1 billion exit. I'd done a few companies, many of them early to market, but I'd learned a huge amount and I had a good network and felt that that was a problem that really needed solving. So I partnered with my friend, now business partner, Andrew Galt, who's still on the West Coast. And together we've been investing since then, nearly 10 years now, and we've done over 100 investments. And yeah, I'm just very excited to be help drive the UK and European ecosystem. And we still invest on the West Coast as well. And it's just an amazing, I'm very lucky to spend so much time with amazing founders. As far as the investment question concerned of operators versus non-operators, the truth is there are amazing VCs and investors in both camps. You know, Fred Wilson, Union Square, an amazing investor, backed so many amazing companies, wasn't a founder himself. I personally think, although I'm biased, that investing early stage, it can be very helpful to have been a founder. And I guess I feel that's the case because with both having had success and failure, it gives me a unique insight into the challenges founders face. And that helps me empathize. It means hopefully I can provide some practical advice based on my experiences. But, you know, ultimately, it's true. You don't necessarily always make the lead violinist of the orchestra the conductor, right? So it really does depend. And the investors who meddle in a founder's business, which is often what people cite as being a problem, well, I think they may have been micromanagers when they were CEOs of their own businesses. So, you know, you do have to be careful also not to wrongly apply pattern recognition because companies change, you know, the way we run companies change. The market's definitely changed and the technology's changed since I started, you know, well over 20 years ago. So hopefully the personal struggles, I don't think, have changed though. And, you know, needing a trustworthy sounding board, working with investors who are going to be transparent in how they operate and back you ambitiously, I think that hasn't changed. And I take great pleasure in trying to be the investor I would have wanted when I first started my company.
Yeah, I think that's really amazing. I mean, we're going to talk about actually the European ecosystem and kind of what you're doing around the LP base a little later on in the podcast. But I was really interested there. You know, you talked about not having been through the $1 billion exit, but then getting into venture. Presumably you had some capital that you could deploy at that time. But I think what that tells me is that you don't need the huge numbers to be able to get into investing. I mean, I do very small check investing, and micro check investing, in fact, is the way I describe it. And it's become easier and easier for people to start deploying and risking their own capital. Would you agree that kind of there's been a bit of an expansion in people's access to venture over the last few years? Is that something that you've noticed? Or do you still think there's a little bit of a kind of closed circle around that sort of stuff?
I think the ability to get into venture and to raise venture funding has transformed, certainly since when I started. I mean, when I raised money for my first startup back in 98, I was sending out stuff in the post to people, you know, printed business plans and, you know, getting faxes back from people still. And there really was no, you know, the dot-com boom sort of came and went pretty quickly. And there was no congealed ecosystem in London, for lack of a better word, in the early 2000s. I mean, that there were people dotted around doing that. And I think that's really started in sort of 06, 07. There was something called Web Mission, which Ollie Barrett took to Silicon Valley. And I was on that along with 20 other founders. And that spawned an initial cluster from which other things grew, such as the ICE network, which I co-founded back in 08. And that's still going strong. And that's a not-for-profit. And that really was all about bringing the founders together so they could share that journey. So raising money is easier than ever. I think raising funds is always a challenge. And a lot of founders don't realize that most VCs who found funds are entrepreneurs themselves. So if you want to get into VC, it's just like any other business. If you've got to really passionately want to do it, and if you want to be a GP running your own fund, then you are an entrepreneur and you've got to, by hook or by crook, find a way to get into that, to get the track record, to demonstrate that you are able to do something better and different to other people. It's just like a founder trying to convince me that they have an idea, or they have the start of a company, or the early trappings of a product, and that they are the best person to be successful in that market and to create a new market or to market the product. And it's really the same. Obviously, there are biases within the ecosystem. I think they're real. But I don't think it's, unless you're born with money or win the lottery, you know, you're not, it's no easy ride for anybody raising a fund. And I think there are two types of VC. There are career VCs that work their way up and they get the experience and they join a fund and they might move between funds, a number of funds over the course of their career. And then there are VCs that start from scratch and build a company just as a founder does. So if you're passionate about doing it, you've got to find a way of demonstrating to people to give you money to do that. And I think there are so many ways now to do that that weren't available even to me just nearly 10 years ago, all the way from AngelList funds to syndicate platforms to scouting platforms. And, you know, so there are multiple ways to get into it. It's just like anything else in life. You've got to be scrappy and you've got to keep going.
Yeah, I think that's definitely very true from the conversations we've had with a number of emerging fund managers over the course of the podcast, both in the US and the UK, as well as my own experience. In fact, funny enough, I wrote a piece yesterday for one of our sites around, you know, how does VC work? How does a VC firm and how does a VC fund work? And actually just going through the process of describing how that worked, it was actually very interesting how close a corollary there is to building a business, right? It is the same process. You have to start off with your idea, your vision, you've got to pitch that, you raise your investment, then you've got to effectively build a business around the fund. And I think that's the other thing that it's really important to keep in mind, that, you know, VC is as much a business as it is anything else. And that's really important to that whole journey. So moving on to kind of some of that performance and some of that track record that you were talking about just before, you had some incredibly amazing early exits with Oculus, which exited to Facebook in 2014, and Pony Technology, which exited to Twitter in 2016. But much of your early experience building was more in the software and media tech spaces. Did those exits in highly technical businesses influence the thesis behind 7%? Or was deep tech always something which you felt you had an edge in and that there was an opportunity for outsized outcomes in?
Yeah, well, my co-founder, Andrew Galt, was first checking to Oculus, and I was first checking to Magic Pony. So, you know, that was fantastic and we were very lucky. And I hope that, you know, that luck continues. You're only ever as good as your last exit in venture, very much like the film world. We've always wanted to invest into stuff which is going to be game changing. And one reads about the sort of notional 10x better if you read 0 to 1 that Peter Thiel talks about. But venture is a power law game. And that means that, you know, most of our returns will come from a small number of companies in our portfolio. I think one of the data points I read recently was that 4% of your capital on average generates 80% of your capital return. So when you look at those numbers, every investment we do has to have the potential to return our fund. And if you follow that mantra and you have a reasonable sized portfolio and you do your job well, then you're going to have a winner and you're going to have a return your fund. And when you then look at the sorts of things you want to invest into, you don't want to invest into iterative solutions. You don't want to have things that only move the needle a little bit. You want to have things that transform the way the world works. One of the questions we often ask ourselves is, you know, can I imagine the world working like X in future, you know, in 10 years time? And that is always a challenge to stick to, because there are always great companies which might be have a great future ahead of them, might even be tens of millions return. It might be even 100 million return, but actually that's probably not going to return our fund as an early stage investor. And so you have to pass on those companies and take bigger bets on higher risk. So, you know, we started doing angel investing, both of us, and that was our first portfolio, and that allowed us to get a track record to raise our institutional fund. We've still got, I think, about 35 companies in that first portfolio still running, and some of them are doing immensely well. Flexport, which is transforming the way people ship things around the world, is now, you know, a $4 billion plus company. So definitely in the last 5 years, there's been a greater focus on sort of hardware technology than we expected, or perhaps planned for at least. So we've got a lot more investments in hardware. And I think that's just reflective of the fact that as the revolution of the internet has moved from being, you know, solving the obvious problems to solving things like e-commerce and online bookings to other laggard industries, it's inevitable that the problems become more complex and therefore the solutions are more complex. And you start to touch sort of the real world outside of the digital domain. And so we are investing in, you know, everything from processors to quantum computers to business process reengineering and, you know, food tech and other things, which are going to define, you know, how we love our lives in the next 5-10 years time. But we try and put our money where the biggest impact will be, you know, picking the founders that are trying to solve the big hairy problems with audacious solutions and things ultimately that will make the world a better place and change the way we live and therefore generate a lot of value for us and our investors.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest problems, I think, that founders, certainly in the UK and Europe, I would suggest, where maybe understanding of how venture works has been, you know, less well understood than maybe in the US, where it's had less sort of spotlight on it. One of the problems is this issue around the understanding of venture mechanics from a financial perspective, which is obviously very clearly, as you said, you know, the ability to return the fund, i.e., you know, if you have a 10% stake in a business after you've, you know, invested initial and then follow on capital 10%, if you have a 100 million fund, you need that business to exit for at least $1 billion for it to be able to return the fund. And I think there's been a lot of people that sort of sit there and say, well, why can't a VC just invest in like 10 businesses that return 100 million, or rather exit for 100 million each and return 10 million each to the fund? And I'm like, but it's much harder to spot and to coach and to manage 10 businesses that, you know, get to 100 million than it is potentially to take those big swings at those really audacious enterprises that, you know, could exit for $1 billion. And I think that that's a really tough thing for a lot of founders and entrepreneurs to get their heads around, because whilst the opportunity that they are chasing may be big, it just may not be big enough, right? And I think that's a really hard problem to understand, but also there's partly an ego issue within that, right? Whereby you feel if a VC turns you down, it's a personal slight on you or your business, whereas actually it's a numbers game, right? And I think one of the core things, and it was one of the, not the hardest learnings, it was a light bulb moment when I had, I can't remember who it was that I was talking to, but you know, they effectively said to me, well, like ultimately your first fund is all about raising your second fund, and VC is all about making money for you and your LPs. It is a business like any other, right? And I think that is the thing that can come as quite a bit of a shock to a lot of entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and I think you make a really great point about understanding the VC model before you go and raise from them, right? You know your enemy for art of war. So, you know, founders should do their, you know, compared to the exciting products they're building, spend some relatively boring time researching VCs, understanding how the model works, understanding how the carry model works, understanding, you know, what the motivations are of the people they're talking to internally. And that's especially true when you're talking to larger firms where you have a hierarchy and you have associates and you have partners, and quizzing the people you talk to about how their companies work and how they really make decisions, and don't be satisfied with a sort of a shallow answer on that. But I wrote a blog post a long time ago about, you know, why don't founders ask more questions of their investors and angels and do more due diligence? And it's actually a great way for founders to get to know the people they're talking to by making sure that first call, you know, half the call, you have a whole set of questions you want to ask about the VC, because you'll understand a lot more about how transparent they are, how open they are, what their temperament's like, how much do they really know about what they're doing, about their own job, you know, how many investments have they done of your stage and ticket size and or sector in the last 6 months. You know, ask for tangible answers. And if they're withholding and the investor's not being open and they're struggling with answers, then that's a flag to you in itself, because you're getting into bed with these people, you know, you often can't get rid of them. And having someone who's taken bad money myself, and, you know, been kicked, essentially kicked out of one of my own companies, you know, that is a painful journey to go through. You don't want to go through. So I think everything you've said is absolutely right, that, you know, understand the model. And different VCs are different. You're now getting, there is a new, that there's more sort of evergreen long-term capital, especially for deep tech. There's also in the UK, a whole bunch of EIS funds that don't have, they probably wouldn't admit it themselves, but they don't have the same expectations of return, because they're essentially a tax optimization vehicle that, you know, funds which are not EIS might do, like ourselves, that have a very sort of Silicon Valley style of investment. So you should think about that, and you should look at the sorts of companies in the portfolio they invest in, and don't waste your time talking to the people who don't share the same ambition level as you. You know, turn those questions around on the investor and ask, you know, what does success look like for you from your fund? What multiple are you expecting? How does that fit with your investment thesis? You know, really grill the investors, because you'll learn a lot about investing and you'll be a better salesperson for your business consequently.
Yeah, I think that's incredible advice. One thing we're going to have to dig into maybe on another podcast is getting kicked off your own cap table. I mean, this is something, you know, I've heard about and seen maybe once or twice in my own time working with startups. And as you say, it's definitely not a pleasant thing to be party to in any way, shape or form. But, you know, these are the sort of things that I think, again, founders should be really, really conscious of when they're reading through the term sheet. You know, what are the conditions on that term sheet? You know, not just in terms of capital being invested, but the kind of control elements, and what are they selling apart from equity, because it is a transaction. And you want to make sure that the investors you're getting onto your cap table are investors that you can have hard conversations with and know that they are going to act, you know, in the best interests of both you as well as their fund, because ultimately is an investment they're making in you, right? And in fact, coming on to that, I assume that, you know, for the sort of ventures that 7% is investing in, your conviction doesn't have to just come from the founding team, which is one of the things, you know, that almost every single investor in VC that we've had on the podcast has said. But it also has to come, I guess, either from the tech that they have built, or at the very least a signal that the team can build that tech. So given how early in a startup's lifecycle 7% invests and you're investing, what are the key things that you're testing for before you write those checks?
When I started investing, if you'd asked me to pencil down what are the variables I measure on for early stage investing, it would have probably been a sort of blend of, yeah, definitely a big chunk of the person, the individual, the founder, plus, you know, product, plus tech, IP. The longer I do this early stage investing, the more and more I'm reminded that it's all about the person. So it's a bit of a cliche answer, but it really is. And the difficulty, of course, with that is that people are the hardest things to measure. But these companies are so hard, and culturally, you have to really have the determination and resilience and ambition to build, you know, a multi-billion dollar business. So things such as the balance of conviction and the ability to filter feedback and then action feedback, you know, is the person coachable? But you don't want them too coachable, because you don't want lots of mentors in their ear, you know, pulling them every which way. That's always something we're keen to look for. And it's not on the ambition side, it's not in the founder's interest for us to back them if we're not aligned. And we definitely, very early on, a couple of my early investments definitely made the mistake where we as founders, you know, Andrew Gott, my business partner, is an ex-founder as well, sort of projected onto the founder what we would do with the business and just made assumptions about what they wanted to do with the business. And then it very soon, quickly after the investment transpired, that actually what was driving them was very, very different to what would excite us about the outcome. And one of the things I've realized is that there are sort of two types of CEO. There are CEOs, startup CEOs, that love running the business, and they might do a very good job of running the business, but their passion is for, you know, building that product or, you know, some element of running a business and everything that goes along with that. And then there are CEOs that are passionate about growth. And what they get off on is growing that business, no matter what. Even if they have to pivot, even if they throw the product away and start again, they want to solve, you know, a problem on this planet, and they will build whatever business they need to and do whatever they need to solve that problem and grow a business in the process to do that. And that's a distinction now we try and tease out when we talk to people by sort of asking, you know, trying not to ask leading questions to ensure that we're aligned and to see how they think about that. So we look for a playbook. And I think that playbook then reflects the things you touched on about, you know, the product, what product they may have built, what IP there is, you know, and if you're coming to us with a blank sheet of paper and you need funding to build something because it takes capital to do so, that might be acceptable. But if we look at what you say you want to build, and we can look at that and go, well, there are lots of lean ways you can test that, you know, and you haven't done any of those things. You haven't put a website up and you don't have a wait list and you haven't tried to, you know, talk to any customers. You know, they are all warning flags that you're not really thinking about this deeply enough. And you don't have a playbook of your own as to how you're going to get to the end of year one, raise that next funding, and ultimately, you know, accelerate this business. And that really comes across with teams. We spoke to a team, actually, we didn't do the investment in the end, but they were building a B2B enterprise SaaS product. And the team was second time founders. It was a group of three co-founders. And they spent the first 2 months before they talked to investors speaking to 200 CXOs of enterprise companies they were going to talk to understand exactly what to build. And then they wireframed and prototyped the whole thing. And they already had LOIs signed. You know, that's minimal cost. That's just time. On the flip side, we've invested obviously in something like Universal Quantum, which took 15 years of IP out of the university. They span that out. And then, you know, we were first checking into that company. So companies come in all shapes and sizes, but you've got to look at, you know, what can you do today to demonstrate traction? You know, people who have heard of, you know, read Paul Graham, you know, who's obviously the founder of Y Combinator, will know he always talked about RAM and profitability. And, you know, they'll teach you, try and get customers, try and get payment, try and get a pain point proven. That's not always possible with deep tech. But with many companies, it is.
Yeah, I think that's a really strong answer, because often I think it's way too easy to say it is just about, you know, it's about the founder and the founding team, like in the sense that obviously, as you said, it's very hard to be objective about a founder, right? Like it's hard to test for some of those things that you talked about. And therefore, you need to see those demonstrations, if you like, of the founder's grit, of their ability to, as you say, to build as opposed to just sort of coast along. One of the things that I find really interesting is, you know, there are, in my mind, I think you kind of described it in this way, there are two types of CEOs. There are people who like managing and there are people like building. Interestingly, I think the CEOs that like building should probably leave the business relatively early on, and certainly in terms of managing the business, because I mean, I can talk for myself for a second here as well. Like, I know that I'm not the sort of person that enjoys the process of managing teams and managing a business, but I do love, you know, building the product, getting out there, getting it in front of customers, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, it takes a little bit of self-awareness. And maybe this is something that comes a little bit with age. I'm kind of in my mid-40s, to know that actually, you know, there are some parts that I'm good at, and there are other parts that I'm not good at. And therefore, actually, I need to bring other people in to solve for the bits that I'm not good at. And actually, you know, this is one of the things that definitely comes out in a lot of the conversations we've had. It isn't just about the founder or the founding team. It's also about the people they're then able to bring in around them who can fill some of those gaps, right? Which I think is massively important.
Yeah, and you make a good point, right, about that person who's a great manager or a great product person. They should probably be a CPO, or they should partner with someone to be the CEO who is going to run through walls and is that, you know, is obsessed with growth and closing that deal or closing that investor. You know, companies take all shapes and sizes, but I'm always, there is a bit of an ego trip that comes with having the CEO title. And actually, you know, if you need more than that one person, you know, it's even harder to, you know, you can't be everything to everybody. And that person at the tip of the spear is nothing without the person behind them. But the person at the tip of the spear has to be able to run through walls. And I know, you know, if you talk to Andrew Galt about why he backed Brendan with Oculus, it's because, you know, he is someone who will just out execute everybody and he'll just run through walls to get stuff done. And so when he partnered with Palmer Luckey, you know, had a guy with a vision and a product, a very early concept of a product, that was a great partnership. So we really look for that determination.
Yeah. And I think without that determination, you know, we talked earlier about the outsized outcomes. It's very hard to get to those outsized outcomes. So it makes a lot of sense that you need, you know, you need someone at the helm that is going to take it in that direction. Moving on to a little bit about kind of the state of the ecosystem a little bit at the moment, like given the acceleration in various trends that we've seen as a result of the pandemic, how do you see the applications of AR and VR moving over the coming years? Can we all hang out in the metaverse? And if we're going to be hanging out in virtual worlds, why are ventures like one of the Japanese ones that was in an FT article recently was looking to build sort of tactic feedback and pain, you know, mechanisms that could deliver pain to make it feel like we were more in the real world than in the virtual world? I mean, how do you see that all kind of playing out as we move forward?
Yeah, great question. I'll take the first half first. I think timing's incredibly hard to predict. Inflection points are hard, often hard to predict. And, you know, we could place bets on where we are in the in Moore's curve on the metaverse hype. You know, are we at the initial peak and about to drop into the trough of disillusionment? Or was that the last few years and we're coming out of that? Next year has been VR, the VR year for the last 10 years, right? And we've had a lot of inbound on VR over the years because of the Oculus investment. And we've had to say no to an awful lot of it because, you know, we've recognized there aren't enough handsets in circulation and usage is pretty niche. I think that is starting to change. The Quest 2 was definitely a step change in accessibility, usability, cost, and quality. We've got the Apple headset coming out next year, which may hopefully be a 10x improvement again. And if they manage to pull something off, which is, you know, equivalent to the switch from the Nokia N95 smartphone to the first iPhone, then, you know, we really may see that flywheel start to turn. So it's tricky. I think we are still on a flatter curve than people think. So we're having to be very careful about what we back. But to your point about the Japanese company, there is some exceptionally interesting technology being built. We've backed Mind Portal in our portfolio, which is essentially building a computer that is a form of telepathy, or feels like a form of telepathy, where, you know, they're able to read the brain with a non-invasive device, a bit like Neuralink, but without, you know, drilling into your head, to be able to control characters on screen or control your avatar, or to be able to think what you're doing. There are a multitude of applications. So it's going to be, in our lifetimes, it's certainly going to get very, very interesting. I think the jury's out on how much time and who will be spent in the metaverse. And the jury's also out on whether we're really going to see a truly decentralized metaverse or whether we're going to see, you know, guard walls. And I think a lot of that will be driven, much as, you know, the open data promoters of open data would prefer, you know, the decentralized world to be here tomorrow. I think a lot of it will come down to something as simple as user experience. You know, if Facebook was to come out with a metaverse world, 3D, which was way better than everybody else's, and people wanted to spend time in, then they're probably going to suck up the status quo of having sold their data and being stuck in a, you know, garden wall. I hope that's not the case, because I think there are much bigger, more interesting opportunities out there. So we'll see.
Yeah, I think that's exactly kind of the answer I expected, which is a slight hedge. I think there are
very boring answer. I've hedged all the way. That's not what I should be doing as an investor. I should be on point.
Yeah, you should be much more convinced about about where it's going. No, but I think that's absolutely fair, because I think partly I just saw today $600 million has been stolen, I think, from the creators of Axie Infinity, right? I mean, there are still massive issues around what happens in the Web3 world. Some of them will be ironed out. Some of them will be hard to iron out. And if you want to get mass adoption, you need to get people to trust. And today there are still, you know, billion plus, I don't know what the Facebook sums are. I haven't used them for many, many years, but, you know, a billion or a couple of billion users of Facebook, and maybe they would find it much easier to trust a metaverse built by Facebook than built by someone else altogether, right? So I think it does come back to, you know, both the quality of the technology, but also the ease of adoptability. You know, I'm immersed in tech and startups and so on. I've struggled to kind of really get into Web3 and DeFi and so on, because the onboarding process is actually very, very painful. And again, like for the majority of users, that is going to be a pain point that is going to be unsurmountable, right? Because it takes a lot of effort to get yourself onboarded into these technologies. And I think that is definitely one of the problems that needs to be solved before, you know, before we get that mass adoption.
And you can have weird behaviors, because obviously the people who are deep into crypto and DeFi and blockchain at the moment, to some degree, knowledge is power and access is power. And so there is some level of inertia there where some people I've spoken to don't necessarily want this to be much easier because that means their value arguably diminishes. Now, I think
they can't earn the 8,000% that is being, driven in some of these default. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, ultimately, it will be all mass adoption, but I think you've nailed it, right? It is about friction. And when we think about sort of for every field you add to a form online, you lose 10% conversion roughly on average or something. So it's no different when you're trying to get people to adopt new technologies. And that it's no surprise that Coinbase has done so well because they were just easier than everybody else to use. So we are at the, first .com boom, probably in blockchain and in crypto and in DeFi. It is super, super early. We're in the period, which I remember well, in sort of 2000, where I went and spoke at Cambridge Union in against the motion that this house believes that e-commerce is a triumph of hype over reality, where somebody was arguing that, that e-commerce was going to fail and it was all a load of rubbish. And, that was patently and very clearly at the time to me, not true. And we're in that same situation where people are saying that, crypto is, all a load of rubbish and this blockchain stuff, isn't going to go anywhere. It's the future of everything, actually, in the same way that technology and the internet is the future of everything. It's just going to take some time. And most cryptocurrency will probably die a death that exists at the moment. Most of the NFT craze at the moment, I view as tulip mania. That's not because I don't think NFTs have a future. I think absolutely everything's going to involve NFTs. It's just, I think, paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for a random pixelated piece of art that some random person I've never met has created. I don't think necessarily that's going to hold value because art is art no matter what medium it's produced in. So CryptoPunks may well hold their money because they were one of the first, they have a following, but the 100th iteration of a CryptoPunk ripoff, is that going to hold value in 50 years? I doubt it very much.
Yeah, I think this is an entire podcast of its own, which I'd love to dive into actually with someone over the coming weeks and months. But yeah, I mean, I think with all of these technologies, it's also about finding the use case that makes sense that can shine the spotlight on, well, okay, you all said that Bitcoin and Ether and blockchain were pointless. Well, actually, here's a use case where it's proven itself to be really valuable. And I've seen some interesting stuff being done in land registries, in developing economies, in supply chain management. And if you think about, just how difficult, I don't know if you do know, but I mean, I come from a manufacturing background originally, and I know how painful it is to get, move goods across borders and the amount of paperwork that's involved and the chain of custody between, the supplier, the haulier that takes it to the port, the port and customs people on one side that then load it to the ship and et cetera, et cetera. And all the way through that, you've got intermediaries and paperwork passing hands. And if you imagine all of that just happening on chain, there are going to be some significant savings and more transparency and better sort of efficiency within that whole system. And the problem with that is it's very mundane and it impacts everyone, but it doesn't actually impact most people on a day-to-day basis in terms of being visible. Once there is something visible like that, I think you'll see a lot more interest and adoption beyond the hype. So I think you're spot on. I think we're at the cusp of something. It's figuring out what that something is that is going to be really interesting over the coming years.
Yeah, we're investing in Web3 right now. We're investing in stuff which is going to be huge. And I think to your point, absolutely, there are so many applications for on-chain and blockchain. And it's going to be really exciting next few years to see how quickly some of these get adopted. But for sure, it's the next. We're living through a revolution, even if it doesn't feel like it. This is the heady days of the early web, and it's very exciting.
Amazing. Look, moving on slightly, in an interview with TechRound back in January, you talked about how much the UK and European venture landscape has changed. Can you talk us through what that change has been and what it has meant? In addition to that, look, we've talked a fair amount on the pod about how opaque the business of venture is, and we talked about that earlier today as well, and how much more diversity at the LP level, especially for new fund managers, could cascade or should cascade through the ecosystem. I'd love to understand more about how you think the event that you co-founded, Allocate, might help drive some of that change.
Great. Well, Allocate was started because Lomax Ward of Outsize Ventures and myself were frustrated that there was not an event for tech VC that was focused on venture capital, not affiliated with private equity, which is a whole different asset class and a different way of doing business, and particularly at the emerging manager end. And I had pitched at something called Raise on the West Coast a couple of years ago, and Lomax went the following year and pitched and came back, and we were just catching up as we do, and was whinging about the fact that Raise was really good and there was nothing in Europe that we thought was any good. So I just said, look, why don't we just do something ourselves? So in 3 months, we spun up a one-day event in person at the time. This was pre-COVID. We got about 50 LPs along, about 150 GPs, and we did Europe's first ever pitch event. So VCs could submit decks just as startup founders would. And we had about 80 VCs submit their decks, and then we had 30 of them pitch on stage. And we really didn't know how this was going to go. To our amazement, actually some pretty big names in VC submitted their decks to pitch, which was really nice to see. And it gave the event, I think, sort of authority to speak going forward. And it proved that the event was needed. So that was a great success. Off the back of that, the following year, during COVID, we then did another event. We had 150 LPs, so investors in VC this time. We had about 400 VCs. It was all online over 3 days. We had people pitching and we had content. That was a great success again. And now we're going to be spinning off a community off the back of that. And that's really taking my learnings from ICE that, you know, business is about connections, and it's about not just shallow connections, but deep connections. And you don't really get those through just a quick meeting or even just, you know, a quick drinks event. You've got to spend time with people. And that's how ICE grew organically. We stumbled upon this recipe that if you stick people away on a ski trip or you take them away on a summer retreat for 2-3 days, they spend time together, they really build really deep personal bonds and friendships. And VC is definitely an industry that's built on relationships. You know, a lot of family offices that I will speak to say, well, we don't even invest in a fund unless we've known the general partner for at least 3 years. So you can imagine trying to raise money for as a startup and having to know a general partner 3 years before they invest. Well, for us, it's even worse. So we've basically modeled this nonprofit organization on that basis. And our goal is nothing less than to ensure that the UK and Europe is the best place in the world to raise money as an ecosystem and hopefully surpass Silicon Valley.
I think that's incredible. I know Lomax, or I think I've had some dealings with some people that Lomax has been involved in the past, and I know he's spoken very highly of. One of the things that kind of jumped out at me, and just as you were saying it, I was about to say the same thing, you know, the whole business of venture, as you say, is massively relationship driven. And that comes back to the fact that, as you said, it's about the people, right? So that in the same way that as VCs, you're investing in the founder or the founding team and their ability to attract talent to them, LPs are doing the same thing. The difference is that the LPs have, you know, a different set of criteria in what they're looking for as compared to what a VC is looking for in a founder. So a VC is looking for in a founder someone who can execute very well and build very quickly. What an LP is looking for in a VC is someone that can identify those businesses that are going to execute very well and build very quickly and return capital. And this is the really important point, return capital with a premium. Right? That there is no point for an LP tying up their cash for 5-10 years if they don't think there is a likely return of, you know, a significant return beyond what they can get in the money markets. And of course, over the next 12 months, I think we're going to see some of that dynamic changing as interest rates rise and the sort of risk reward appetite changes. I think one question I would definitely want to ask you is, I have the impression that the LP ecosystem in Europe tends to be slightly more, should we call, staid and old school, right? It is asset managers coming from, you know, the pension funds, family offices, as you mentioned, but people who are maybe slightly less risk, have slightly less risk appetite than maybe in the US. You talked about some of the EIS funds and, you know, it's tax-driven investing rather than, you know, innovation and outsized return-driven. Would you say that that's changed, or is my feeling correct, or is that completely off the mark?
No, I think you're absolutely right. VC, raising money from LPs is a bit like raising money from Series A VCs, you know, in the early 2000s. Some of them don't even have websites. Some of the websites don't have any email addresses. You know, they don't really say what they do. You have to, it's like getting blood out of a stone to understand what their investment thesis is. So it is changing though. And you have sort of next generation fund of funds and LPs. You know, I'm thinking even in Europe, I'm thinking of like Ertan Can from Multiple Capital. You know, he's active on Twitter. He engages. He's not shy to give opinions. He's focused on the numbers and results and is pretty democratized in the way he will speak to, you know, anybody who's got a sensible pitch to give him, much like good VCs should. There's also a movement and has been for some time on the West Coast in the US, you've got Sapphire Ventures, you've got Industry Ventures, you've got, you know, a whole bunch of fund of funds that have been established for quite a long time there, who have moved with the times and become more open and more engaged in the ecosystem. I'm thinking like Beza Clarkson with her hash OpenLP initiative on Twitter. And I think that all helps to socialize what goes on in the ecosystem and helps asset managers who might want to get into VC and should want to get into VC, because don't forget, technology is the future of everything. And VC is on an exponential growth curve, I think, which will continue, to understand how this industry works. And, you know, a lot of the, there is so much opportunity in technology now that it's going to continue to touch every part of our lives. And all that technology needs funding. And the ability to build technology faster continues to accelerate. And traditional financial channels, you know, banks or other things, just aren't well suited to lend to these sort of companies. So I think, you know, when you look at Europe still only deploys about a quarter of the money that's deployed into the US into technology startups. And that's despite the fact Europe having grown some crazy figure. I can't remember the figure. You can check Atomico's, you know, startup, annual startup report, but it's something like 5 times the amount of money is going deployed in Europe than was, you know, 6-7 years ago or something crazy. But the amount of money has continued to increase in the US as well, in North America. And so consequently, in terms of neck and neck, we're still not. I mean, we're still as far behind the US in terms of the amount of money we're deploying as we were 5 years ago. And that needs to change. And that needs to change for Europe. That needs to change for the UK. It needs to change for reasons of national security, of sovereign capability, and just for the future of our GDP. Because, you know, if you don't have access to if you have restricted access or access at a very high price to quantum computing, or to the next generation of AI, generalized AI, or of the ability to produce and create next generation medical devices or medical treatments, then that's going to fundamentally affect society. And, you know, so we have no choice but to invest more on that. And the government's started in that direction. The British Business Bank is doing a great job, but we need multiple times more money to be made available, either through tax incentives or through regulatory changes for pension funds, or through a sovereign wealth fund, you know, to get that money into the grassroots technology industries, because that's where the next big, you know, British aerospaces and the next big Googles are going to come from.
Amazing. And I think I would just add as an addition to that, two things. Not only, you know, do we need to unlock that capital, but we need to ensure that we have the best and the brightest coming out of our universities, which means, you know, making sure that we can attract, you know, the best scientists and the best sort of creators even into the economy, so that they can, you know, they can ensure that we are building those next generations of technology. And equally, to your point, again, making sure that whatever we do from a tax perspective, you know, makes it much more democratized for individuals to get into the business of backing great startups, so that, you know, again, not only does the wealth get spread around, but also those returns get recycled through the economy. And the final thing, which is actually the most critical thing, I think, in my opinion, is making sure that we decentralize out of London and ensure that there is incredible access to that capital in regions outside of London, you know, whether that's Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, or the rest of England. And in fact, we've had, you know, one of the investors from the Development Bank of Wales, Alex Lee, on the podcast, and we will be talking to Scottish Enterprise soon. And we've talked to Jenny Irvine from Raise Ventures in Northern Ireland. There is so much opportunity out there, but, you know, I think there is a very London-centric view, certainly here in the UK.
And I'll tell you one more podcast you should do to add to your list, Arish.
Okay, please do.
A podcast on university spin-outs. And I'd be happy to contribute to that, but also you should speak to Nathan at Air Street. He's been doing a lot of work to help surface the sort of deals that most of which are crappy, I might add, from UK universities. You know, we've done 3 or 4 deals in the last sort of 24 months and been instrumental in helping the founders negotiate a commercially sensible exit structure, which is simple, that's clean, that doesn't smell bad, as we often say. You know, we often see technology coming out of UK unis and we look at the deal and my partner and I say to each other, oh God, it smells funny. Now, you've got all sorts of weird warranties or caveats, or the university and the first investor own like 70% of the cap table, and that's going nowhere, right? You can't, it's uninvestable. So that's an area that needs attention.
Well, I would love the intro to Nathan. I have reached out to him on Twitter. He has not responded. So, Nathan, if you're listening...
He's a popular man, but I'll do my best.
We'd love to get you on. And look, his State of AI report is absolutely fantastic. Well worth a read for anyone who's interested in that. And to your point, like, the big problem we see with these university spinouts is obviously, as you say, the cap tables can often be structured really poorly, but equally, you know, the universities have first right of refusal, license and royalty kind of arrangements, which just make, you know, the technology completely unlicensable, you know, beyond the kind of non-commercial aspects. Andrew, I've taken a huge amount of your time, but I just want to add one sort of last question. You know, here at Nothing Ventured, we are ridiculously passionate about entrepreneurship and the opportunities it can bring. You're someone who left college, or as we just learned earlier, were kicked out of college and dived into that life. How much has the landscape changed over the last 20 years? And how would you encourage more people to embark on that journey today?
God, a great question. How would I encourage more people to embark on this journey? Well, I'm a big believer you've got to do something you enjoy doing, right? I'm a believer that we get satisfaction from mastery. You know, the reason computer games are addictive is because they're hard right up to the point where you're going to walk away and say, screw this, I can't do it. And then you have a breakthrough and then you feel you've mastered something and then you come back and you feel good about yourself and you do some more. And this is a human behavior and a psychological trait, which is very, very deeply ingrained in us. So I think whatever you do, you should always be striving to be the best at whatever you do. And so all the better if you're doing work which you're passionate about. And I don't think actually that matters whether you start a company or whether you work for another company or whether you join a not-for-profit. But if you do start a company, it is exceptionally rewarding. And it's hard. It's a roller coaster. But you learn on the job. And there is no better school of life, I think, than being an entrepreneur. I've often talked to people who say, oh, I'm just going to do this or I'm just going to do that. And then I'm going to start my own company. And I always say to them, just start your company. Because no entrepreneurship course is really going to move the needle, I don't think, on whether your company is successful or failure. The people you surround yourself with, the problem you choose to solve, the information that is all out there on YouTube and blog posts and in books, which wasn't available to me when I started, is all there now. You don't need a degree to go and do that. You probably need a degree to go and be a brain surgeon for obvious reasons, but you don't need a degree to start a company. So go out there and get started and just grasp the nettle. The reason why I became an investor is because I had to step back and look at, actually, it was a friend, Jonathan McDonald, who said, when I was trying to decide which way to jump, he said to me, you know, what are you good at? What do you love doing? And what will people pay you for? And whatever sits in the middle of that, that's what you should go and do. And that's a really great piece of advice to sketch that down on a piece of paper. And then I overlaid one other filter, which was, what was my unfair advantage? Now, if you're straight out of college, you might think you don't have an unfair advantage, but I would challenge that and say you probably do. You might be great with people. You might be great analytically. You might be hugely creative. You know, there'll be something which you are better at than other people that you can apply to whatever you choose to do. For me, my unfair advantage was that I'd had over 20 years of success and failure in startups from a very early stage and a network, therefore, and relationships, which you can't just build overnight. And I felt that that was going to stand me in really great stead with my experience from Silicon Valley in Europe, because I felt I understood the founder's journey and I was passionate about not behaving as the same way as 95% of all the investors I'd ever experienced in Europe. So far it's worked out pretty well and I'm really enjoying it. But I just say, you know, whatever you're doing, start doing what you're passionate about, do something meaningful, do something that challenges you, because getting up in the morning will be a whole lot better when you're challenging yourself and you're basically mastering something, whatever that is.
Amazing advice. I mean, I call the podcast Nothing Ventured for precisely that reason. I launched a business during the pandemic and I launched this podcast during the pandemic.
That's amazing.
Neither of which I actually had any real understanding of where they were going to go. And of course, was continuing to build my other business at the same time. So, you know, I think what's really interesting is I spent 10, 15 years working in supposedly entrepreneurial environments, but they're actually quite stifling because there wasn't the ability to go out and just try. I think one of the things that is really important for us to understand in the UK and Europe, or not understand, but to rid ourselves of, is this kind of stigma around failure. I think precisely to your point, we all have unfair advantages that we can use to try and start something. You just have to be conscious that not everything you start is going to work out, and that's okay. I think the point is the starting, right? The end point could be anything. Who would have predicted in 2020, you know, this has been overdone and oversaid, who would have predicted that we would have had a pandemic and how many businesses effectively stopped as a result or weren't able to operate as a result of that, but also how many businesses were created as a result of that, right? So I think exactly to your point, you've just got to get started. I absolutely agree that, you know, going off and learning from an MBA might be valuable, but there is nothing more valuable than just getting started. Or, you know, if you don't feel like you're comfortable getting started today, then maybe join a startup that is on that journey where you can learn and then, you know, jump on that journey yourself.
Absolutely. Well, two things I'd like to finish with. One is, first of all, Nothing Ventured is a great name for a podcast. Really love it. And so important, I think, branding in the podcast and when you're trying to launch something new. And then to your point around failure, I mean, I've had more failure than success, I'd probably say, on balance. And, you know, there's a reason why on my Twitter banner, I've quoted Churchill, which is, you know, the success is the ability to go from one failure to another without any loss of enthusiasm. And I think that's definitely true in startup world, but probably true in life as well.
Amazing. Andrew, it's been absolutely incredible talking to you today. For our listeners, where can they find you? Are you on Twitter or on LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to look for you online?
Absolutely. You're welcome to connect on LinkedIn, although my LinkedIn inbox is a dark black hole I don't like to talk about. So best connect on Twitter and at Andrew J. Scott, 2 T's.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Andrew. It's been wonderful having you here today.
Pleasure's all mine.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.